Lesson 3, the present tense indicative mood verb. First, the vocabulary list. These are all verbs. These are all omega verbs, if you'll notice the ending of each verb. I will read the verb and then the translation. Gnosko, I know. Grapho, I write. Didasko, I teach. Agairo, I raise or I raise up. People translate that differently depending on their preference. Thelo, I wish or I desire. Lambano, I take or I receive. Lego, I say or speak. More likely say, because it's a non-technical word that means to say something aloud. Pimpo, I send. Fero, I bear or I bring. The Greek verb, 3.2, the Greek verb, tense. Tense is the quality of the verb that tells time and kind of action. You'll notice there's a footnote with kind. The term kind is the older grammatical term that was used for the aspect of the action. Today, people often use the term aspect rather than kind, but what it refers to is the nature of the verbal action. We'll talk more about this as we go through. In English, we think of tense as telling only time, but in Greek, the kind of action is more fundamental to the idea of tense than time. For that reason, Greek tenses occur with infinitives and participles, as well as with pure verbs. This is rather important as well, because you'll notice the footnote says that English also has tense and voice with infinitives and participles. For instance, the infinitive phrase to have been eaten is a past tense passive voice infinitive. To have been eaten by an alligator must not have been much fun. I put that in there as a joke. Maybe I should take it out. It's not very funny. Greek has the following tenses: present, aorist, imperfect, future, perfect, and pluperfect. Greek has the following kinds of action. Now, these are general, so we'll discuss these more detail as we come to them. Progressive, sometimes called linear. Undefined, sometimes called punctiliar, which views the action as a complete whole act, that is, the undefined. And perfected, which indicates the action as having a result. Each tense is associated primarily with one kind of action. Primarily is the key here. Both present and imperfect are linear, though they have other contextual uses. The aorist is undefined or completed and can take on elements of both imperfect or even the perfect tenses. The black dot, sometimes used as an illustration of the aorist, can be misleading. In fact, I've eliminated it from my consideration because I think it is misleading. It does not mean a point in time or once for all, as some claim. It indicates the ultimate in an undefined whole, the simple use of the verb with reference to no specific kind of action. This is sometimes called punctiliar, which is an imprecise term. It's the one I learned when I was taking first year Greek way back in the Dark Ages, and seems to imply a point in time. Better would be static, which can also be used of the present in some contexts. It means no progress or lack of progress is indicated, though the action can take place over a long period of time. The aorist tense has no boundaries. The two perfect tenses are special cases when it comes to both time and kind of action. The perfect tense indicates past action with present result. That result may either be progressive or undefined. The pluperfect tense indicates past action with past result. Again, the result may be progressive or undefined. However, as with English past perfect, the Greek pluperfect, the action and its result is viewed as complete before the time of the speaker's or writer's statement. Voice. Voice is the quality of the verb that shows whether the subject is acting or being acted upon. Only action verbs have voice. State of being verbs do not show action and therefore are considered voiceless. Now, this is a very important thing, which is underemphasized in Greek. There's a footnote here. It says the technical grammatical term for active and passive voice verbs is transitive. This is a word you don't hear much in Greek studies, sadly. Verbs that are either active that are neither active nor passive are correctly identified as intransitive. More on these terms in section 3.3 below. So we'll keep these in mind as we go through the lessons. I've given you a little chart here of the voice and the indication of the voice. Active voice, the subject is acting upon a direct object. And in fact, in order for a verb to be active voice, it must have a direct object. Passive voice, the subject is being acted upon, often by an agent found in a prepositional phrase, using by or through as the preposition. Sometimes, however, the agent is not expressed. Most Greek grammars refer to something called the middle voice. For English students, this is difficult, since it redefines the word voice in a way that makes little sense. In fact, the term middle voice is a mistake that needs to be corrected. Yet, it is still in common use. We will discuss it as we continue through Greek grammar. I will say one more thing about that at this point. The term middle voice is used so universally, including in lexicons and so on, that it's probably impossible to get rid of it. But it is not an accurate statement as to the nature of the Greek verb. We'll talk more later on. The third aspect of the verb is mood. Mood is the quality of the verb that indicates whether the action or state is real or potential. By the way, I do not mean true or false. Real or potential is different. In English, we express potential action in a variety of ways. Greek has similar methods, but not identical. Note the following moods. Indicative mood means that it indicates the reality of the action or state. This is the most common mood in language. The vocabulary form of Greek verbs are always presented in the indicative mood, with their indicative mood translation into English. Note the footnote. This does not mean that the statement is true. I already mentioned this. It only means that the writer or speaker is indicating that the action or state is real. True and real in grammar are distinct. The statement may be true or it may be false. It may even be a lie. But if it's in the indicative mood, it is indicated as being real at the time stated, not potential to a future or possible time stated. A good example for the indicative mood is, in English we say things like, I am eating dinner. We could put that in the future tense, by the way. I will be eating dinner, and it's still in the indicative mood. Or, I ate dinner, it's still in the indicative mood. The action is viewed as real. Mother is driving the car. Again, it could be past or future, but it's still indicative mood. Yesterday, I ran into Bob on my bicycle. The reason I put this in here is because the action is viewed technically as indefinite, but it is still viewed as real. In a sentence like this, you cannot tell who was on the bicycle. So it's an indefinite action. It's a poorly written sentence, but the verb is still in the indicative mood. The subjunctive mood, the next one in the column, indicates the action or state is potential. And again, there's a footnote here, and we should look at that. The subjunctive, imperative, and optative moods, those are the other three moods besides the indicative, are all potential moods. There is no claim that the action or state is real, only that it could be real at some future point. Once one leaves the indicative mood, whether it be with a change of mood or with an infinity or participle, those are also outside the indicative mood, the action or state is no longer considered absolute because it's only potential. It could happen, it might not happen. There are factors involved in the very meaning of the verbs that are used that indicate such things. So we will be coming back to that as well. Now, So the first statement is in the subjunctive, indicates the action or state is potential. The subjunctive is usually translated into English using the helping verbs may, my, might, could, would, or should. There are other ways as well to indicate subjunctive mood, and we'll talk about them as we go through. Some examples. We may go to the store unless it rains. Again, you can see that the action of going is only, or may go, is only potential. It may rain, it may not, we don't know, but that's what we say. The vet might give the cat an antibiotic. Possible, but it may not happen. It should rain tomorrow, according to the forecast. I jokingly say sometimes that weather forecasters should never speak in the indicative mood. It should always be in the subjunctive, the potential mood. They simply cannot always tell. The next mood, imperative, indicates the possibility that the action or state might occur. It is the mood of command, and in English, usually drops the subject you when giving the man. When you is included, the command is considered emphatic. The action only becomes real if the command is obeyed. But the statement itself indicates the potentiality of it. For instance, the example, Jerry, close the door. Maybe Jerry doesn't close the door, maybe he does, but the command is potential. Or, don't drop that glass. And then you drop the glass. Well, okay, maybe you did or maybe you didn't. You, come here. That's an emphatic imperative. Optative moods are rather a strange duck. The optative mood indicates the removal from reality just beyond the subjunctive. The act or state is viewed as unlikely. It is so potential that it's beyond likelihood. English has no optative mood, so there is no consistent way to translate it from Greek. In fact, we use the subjunctive sometimes as an optative, depending on the context and how we phrase it. There are no English examples, none. We do not study the optative mood until the second year because there are only 67 examples of it in the New Testament. It is used similarly to the subjunctive from our perspective today. So, we'll go on then and talk about that later on. 3.3, the present transitive or intransitive indicative of the verb. Greek grammarians generally use the verb luo as the basic verb for illustration purposes. This is because it is short, three letters, and completely regular in all tenses, voices, and moods. Most verbs, many verbs, are not regular. They may be regular in the tense, but they may change from one tense to another tense. They may be regular in the present tense, but not the future. You just never know. You have to learn them individually. But luo is the best verb to use because it is completely regular all through tense, voice, and mood. Before examining the verb luo, we must discuss two more elements dealing with the verb, person and number. English and Greek are identical in the person and number possibilities in both languages. There are three persons and two numbers. Oh, there is a footnote here, and I know what this one is too. It has to do with the history of Greek. At one time, Greek had a dual number, indicating only things that came in pairs. But by the Koine Attic period, it had dropped out of the language. It's interesting that Hebrew still has that. And there are forms of nouns, for instance, that are purely dual forms, not so much in the verbal system. In English, we indicate person and number using personal pronouns. Note the following paradigm of English pronouns in the subjective, I always do that. It's not subjunctive, that's a mood. Subjective or nominative case. We use the word subjective case in English. Most other languages use the term nominative case. Person, notice down the column of the person, there's first person, second person, and third person. The singular pronouns in the first person are I. The plural pronouns are we. The second person, in English, singular and plural are identical, you and you. There was a time in English in which there was a plural you and a singular you. That is no longer true. Third person is he, she, or it, or they in the plural. Now, this is consistent throughout the English language. Other languages do it differently. Next paragraph. In Greek, person and number are indicated by personal endings on the verb stem. The stem of a word is what is left after the endings have been removed. And this is one of the great studies that we will be doing in first year Greek. These endings stand for the pronoun, so that no actual pronoun is needed. In the following, for study purposes, the verb stem lou is used, separated by a space from its personal ending. In actual use, of course, no space between the stem and endings occur. In other words, I've done it just so you can see where the ending is and where the stem is. The singular for luo is luo, and the omega means I, so that verb means I loose or I am loosing if it's a pure progressive. The second person is lu ice, you loose or you are loosing, singular only. Third person is lu I, he, she, or it looses or is loosing, depending on whether it's a man, male, female, or a thing. Now, one of the things we have in Greek, and we'll discuss this in detail, is the it form does not always refer to neuter nouns. And we'll see this as we get into the grammar of the nouns more detail. The plural form of the Greek verb is, in the first person, is luomen. The omen ending means we loose, or we are loosing. The second person plural is lu ete. You loose, you are loosing. And then the third form plural, the third person plural, is lu usi. And then there is a nu at the end in parentheses because it's movable. It occurs sometimes, and it does not occur other times, and we'll talk about it. They loose or are loosing. I've also included the infinitive form here. This is the regular present tense infinitive for omega verbs. Lu ein, to loose, we would translate that. They also have an aorist form of the infinitive. We do not have pure past tense infinitives. We do have perfect tense infinitives. So it's a rather strange deal. These personal endings can be added to all verbs whose vocabulary forms in whose vocabulary form ends in omega. Note the third person plural usi, and then I'm going to talk about the movable nu here. The last letter in parentheses is called a movable nu. It usually occurs when the next word begins with a vowel, but not always. It is truly up to the writer whether he uses it or not. It also occurs with other endings, which we will study when we come to them. And this is a rather important thing. We also have one in English. We have a movable in, we call it. The indefinite article a is written an before a word beginning with a vowel. Example, a cat, but an apple. And we fall into that. We don't even think about it. Same thing with the Greek language. That's a movable in. Well, in Greek, they have the movable nu. There you have it. The following chart, then, indicates just the endings. They are called the primary active endings in most grammars, though verbs with these endings are sometimes voiceless. Voice is a function of the verb in a context, not a form that can be read. And this is one of the great failings of first year Greek. And I have taught many years, and I fell into this error myself, and now I am correcting it. Many verbs occur with these endings that are not active because they do not, in context, they do not have a direct object in their sentence. They are intransitive, and therefore neither active nor passive. Memorize the endings in the columns in which each is printed. Here are the endings, and I'm just going to go through the endings. I'm not going to look at that chart, but you should learn them this way. O, ice, I, that's the first column. Amen, ete, usi. O, ice, I, amen, ete, usi. And the infinitive, ein. Memorize those. Say them out loud. Write them. Do what it takes to memorize them, because this is the regular present tense indicative mood form for all the omega verbs, that is, verbs that, with their vocabulary form, have an omega in the indicative mood. Luo, akuo, and all those others take these same endings. There's a paragraph under that chart. These endings occur with transitive active voice verbs and with verbs that are complete. Now, a complete verb is a verb that looks like it's transitive active, but it has no direct object. Therefore, it cannot be transitive and it cannot be active. So we call those intransitive complete verbs, but they can have those same endings. Or even state of being verbs, which generally have a different set of endings, but there's one state of being verb specifically that carries these very endings, and there is no voice with them because it's a state of being verb. So it's incorrect to call these transitive, active, or active voice endings, as most grammars do. It's simply an inaccuracy. Now, if you want to know what the verb, the state of being verb is that carries these endings normally, it is huparco. It ends in omega. It means I exist, generally, or even I am under certain circumstances, kind of like another verb. We have another verb for I am, which has got a different set of endings than the omega set. We'll be looking at that when we come to it. That's one of those verbs, like in English, that you have to memorize individually because it's totally irregular. And so we'll be memorizing that as we come to it. Parsing. To parse means to name each element in a form. The order of parsing for verbs is as follows. Tense. Is it present, aorist, imperfect, future, and so on? Transitive state. There are four possible transitive states. Transitive active, transitive passive, we'll be talking about that later, intransitive complete, and intransitive copulative. State of being verbs are sometimes copulative, sometimes complete. Again, we will be going over this later, so don't worry about it right now. Just look at the order. In transitive state, I'll be giving you examples of this as we go through, so you'll know what's going on. So that's the second thing in the list as far as parsing. Then we tell the mood, the person, the number, and the vocabulary form, which is the first person singular in the indicative mood form as it occurs in a vocabulary list. So, luo, for instance, this is the example I use, is present, that's the tense, transitive active, that's the transitive state, indicative, first person singular from luo, if it has a direct object. If it has no direct object, it is present tense, intransitive complete, not transitive anymore, indicative mood, first person singular from luo. Those are the verb luo parsed. If it's in a sentence and it has an object, then it's transitive active. If it's in a sentence without a direct object, it's intransitive complete. Example, the verb luo ice is present, transitive active, or intransitive complete, indicative, second person singular from luo. And you can go through and do all of the forms this way of luo. Now we come to the exercises. Memorize the vocabulary form of each vocabulary word. Review the vocabulary from previous lessons. Memorize the primary active endings in the chart above. Possibly active. Primary endings would be a good way to say it. Ice, I, amen, ette, usi is what I'm referring to there. Exercise. Next exercise. In the following charts, choose 5 verbs from the vocabulary lists and fill in the forms with their translation. I've started the first one for you. I chose the verb grafo. The translation would be writing. The second person would be grafice. The third would be grafi, grafamen, grafite, grafusi, grafine, to write. So fill that in and then go on, choose some other verbs, and I've given you charts all the way down. Exercise, read aloud and translate the following. I recommend that you do a lot of out loud reading. This is very, very helpful. It helped me a lot. I used to have to help people in my first year Greek class when I was taking first year Greek who wouldn't read out loud, and they were having trouble with these. And so I would encourage them to do that even then, because I had studied other languages and I knew then how helpful it is to read out loud. So I'm going to read them for you now, just to help you with them. In Numbers 1 and 2 here. Number 1 starts with ago, akuais, agai, blepamen, echo, agamen, luete, thelusi, lambanais, ferai, lambanete, graphi, gnoskamen. Number 2, agairo, pimpais, ferusin, lambanamen, agate, thelusi, didaskais, graphite, thelamen, legai, agairusin, echais. Read through those a number of times like that. Exercise. Parse and translate the following. The first one is completed for you. You may use abbreviations if you wish. Something that you can make up yourself if you care to. I do sometimes. I'll give you the abbreviations that I use sometimes. Graphite, for instance, is present, transitive active, or intransitive complete, depending on whether it has a direct object or not. Indicative, I should say second person. I think I made a mistake there. I think it says, has an ST there after it, if I'm seeing that correctly. I'll correct that. Second person plural from grapho. Abbreviations, P is present, TA, transitive active, or IC, intransitive complete, I for indicative, 2 for number, and P for plural. That's one way to do it. The translation is you plural are writing. And when I'm translating these for exercise purposes, if it's a plural form, I will put you plural in parenthesis, PL in parenthesis, just to indicate that it's not you singular. And I put a U with S in parentheses if it is singular. It's not necessary to do that when you're translating through the New Testament, but it's good to note it so that you don't make some grammatical and therefore even possible doctrinal mistakes. Believe me, doctrinal mistakes, some serious ones, have been made because of a lack of understanding that person, that the word you in English can either be singular or plural. And in Greek, it's not either. It's one or the other, depending on the ending of the verb. So you've got to look at that very closely. Do that for the rest of the verbs in this chart. It goes on to the next page. That ends our discussion of this lesson. I hope this is helpful for you. If you have any questions, please submit them.